step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Hi, I'm Bunny Guinness, and this is my podcast, Bunny in the Garden, with someone special. Someone who is well known for something other than their green fingers, but who is also a mustard-keen gardener. I'll discover them through their garden, why, how, and when they garden, the best tips they've learnt, and their gardening style and approach. Today, I'm in the spectacular garden with arguably the most renowned football journalist in the UK, Henry Winter. Henry currently writes for World Soccer, having previously been the chief football correspondent for The Times for 8 years. Henry has a lot to say. So as a first, we have split our chat into two halves. Henry, most people know that about you, but what listeners don't know is that your mother was an artist garden designer who worked with Geoffrey Jellicoe, all sorts of garden designer, and she was a horticulturalist and designer. And then your father was John Winter, the famous architect, who apparently never had a planning permission refused and was asked to redesign Portsmouth. So you've got a very design background.
You've done your research. He was definitely, I got quite excited when he got the Portsmouth job, because I thought, oh, I'll get free trips down there and I can go and watch Portsmouth play at Fratton Park. Dad never heard of Fratton Park. He was too busy pushing boats around in Portsmouth Harbour. But yeah, that sadly, actually, he effectively got that taken away from him, which was really sort of broke his heart, actually, because he loved projects like that. He loved history. He loved the heart and soul of Britain, and Portsmouth very much embodied that because of its history and because of the buildings, and he knew that he could do things with it. Because he was very much a modernist architect, Prince Charles, as was now the King, stepped in, and basically Dad lost the job. And it was, I remember the Daily Mail, they actually stood up for Dad and said, you know, we want a respected British architect. And their Portsmouth then got an American architect in who didn't last particularly long. But I always remember that because I thought, you know, you do get adversity in life. And Dad, that really hurt Dad, because it was, you're not architects alike, it's like garden designers. You know, it's absolutely not a simple profession for you. It's an absolute passion.
And so that would have been the job of his career. And he would have made huge contribution and changes to it.
There was an element of Christmas is cancelled, no turkey, you know.
Because presumably that came in at the last minute. So he had sort of thought about this, planned it, thought what he's going
to
do.
And Portsmouth, to their great credit, they did, when the sort of the controversy had died down, they did give Dad one or two jobs, but it wasn't like the sort of Mary Rose and things like that. So if you do go to Portsmouth, they're one or two of Dad's buildings. But actually, I think his best buildings were, he did a beach house for us in Norfolk, which was stunning. But that, I mean, you talk about planning permissions, that had to go all the way to Whitehall, and that had to get ministerial approval, because that was very much Dad was a modern architect in the sort of, I mean, his echoes, and he wrote books. He was a Frank Lloyd Wright scholar at Yale. He got the scholarship from, he was at the Architecture Association, he was one of the sort of the rising stars with that Richard Rogers, Norman Foster, Mike Hopkins was a little bit younger, but that sort of generation. And he went over to America, got this year's scholarship. And in fact, we're reminded of when he passed away a few years back, my brother showed me this letter that Yale had sent to Dad when he'd finished his year on the Frank Lloyd Wright scholarship at Yale. And it said, dear Mr. Winter, congratulations on your successful year being the Frank Lloyd Wright scholar. We wish you all the best in your future career, going off to work for Skidmore in California. Good luck with all that. And obviously, as you've been in the United States of America for a year, you're now eligible for the draft. So yeah. Dad thought, well, I'm not going to, whatever it was, Korea or Vietnam. But he went off to California, worked for Skidmore, worked, again, everything comes back to sport with me. He worked on Candlestick Park, which was a very famous baseball and American football stadium in San Francisco. When I mentioned that to Americans, they go, well, that's like our Lords. You know, that's like our Wembley. That's like Brazil's Maracanã. So I have that sort of connected pride that dad worked on that.
And I remember reading somewhere that he would take you to show you buildings and spaces, and you would think, well, I could get a football picture.
Always. Here. Oh, Versailles. I went round, and I must have been, I don't know, about 7 or 8, quite stroppy, and being dragged around another building. God, it's, you know, dragged around another garden. Apologies, money, and just go. You could get a football pitch in there. I mean, we went to Chenonceau, which is the nice one over the river, and I go, drain the moat. It's not a moat, it's the Loire or whatever it was. So get rid of that, you get some nice five-a-side pitches in there. we got thrown out of East Berlin because by the Red Army, which is hilarious. This is just weird. So quite an interesting family, but quite a calamitous family. And if you look at sort of my career and all the things I've done, I've had so many cock-ups. Like, I just had this thing. I say stupid things on social media. I said something about Newcastle United. The fans said, you're speaking absolute rubbish. I said, I'm not. I said, if this transpires, I'll swim the Tyne. So it then inevitably transpired. I had to swim the Tyne. All that sort of nonsense. So I get all these sort of stupid things that happen. But Dad wanted to go and see this Bauhaus building in East Berlin. I think it was a Gropius building. Dad wrote a book on it. So anyway, so we went through Checkpoint Charlie. This is obviously years before the wall came down. We'd driven from Regent's Park. And Dad started taking these pictures of this quite well-known building, forgetting that there was a Red Army training camp next door. And of course, the Soviet soldiers went absolutely ballistic. And then my mother, who had these sort of quite clever, she was a very good reader of situations. And she said, right, better go out. So they ripped the film out of Dad's camera. And Dad was quite nervous driving out. And we had a Red Army Jeep either side. And Dad was a bit nervous, and he sort of accelerated when he should have braked as we were getting near the sort of barrier at Checkpoint Charlie, went into the Jeep in front. So all these Russian soldiers jumped out and were just doing, what are you doing, mate, in rhyming Muscovite slang or whatever. And my mother very cleverly gave my sister, who was a sort of bundle of blonde curls, and it was probably about 5 at the time, and said, stick your head out the window and offer them some Quality Street, whatever it was, some chocolate. And the Russians, despite what we think of them now, are huge family people. They love kids, sense of humour. They absolutely melt in. They realise this is a, you know, 5 English idiots. You know, we're going to win the Cold War without needing penalties. Just rush them through. So, yeah, family life was, because I was passionate about football from a young age.
And so that's interesting. So even 7 or 8, you got
totally,
it.
Totally, yeah.
And we what had was the earliest you remember becoming passionate?
I don't know. I think probably if I was in a pram, I wanted a ball. And then I just, yeah, it was quite interesting because I remember we were on the beach in Norfolk. My parents just had this beach house there. And this policeman walked along the beach, literally with his helmet on, hot day. And we were looking at him, and he came up to my father and had a quiet word with my father and said, your house, your famous house in London, the glass and steel house, has been broken into and badly vandalised. And this was after The Clockwork Orange, the film came out in the 70s, which was all about the horrible Californian film about smashing houses. And these people have broken into the house, and for 9 hours they'd gone through spraying fuck the rich on the wall, apologies for that, they're defecated in the beds, they're taken all the tropical fish. It's a detached house, no real neighbours. In fact, most of the neighbours are dead because of Highgate Cemetery on both sides. And ground the sort of fish into the carpet, well, slate. And then taken bottles of wine and smashed all those. And it was just, the police actually wouldn't allow us to go back in.
What?
And when the new, initially, until they'd actually cleared it up, because they said it was so disgraceful, but they said there was one thing. They didn't touch the room with all the football stuff in it. And I just thought, God, this is weird. And I didn't whether to feel guilty or relieved that my room had been left untouched, because my room was just a sort of temple to football annuals and footballs themselves and whatever.
Which team at that point?
I'm not allowed to say, because it's just carnage. It was basically England and a passion for football. So, I grew up sort of going around sort of London clubs with mates. But it was mainly playing. It was mainly, you know, I had this lovely idea of being able to write about it, mainly because you could travel the world and just write about football. And so, yeah, just sort of seeing that. And then the police established, they never caught the people who did it. And it became a little slight cause célèbre in the papers, because this famous London house, I think it was the first modern house to be listed. You can't do anything to it now, you know. I mean, slightly impractical house, to be honest, very beautiful. White curtains. Dad insisted on white curtains. So I always wake up every morning at like sort of 4:45, the moment the light is out, which is very useful for work and things like that. But it was a slightly impractical house, but stunning, used for loads of ads, films.
What's its address?
81 Swains Lane. It's known as 81 Swains Lane, yeah. Or locally known as the Glass House. Mm. And so we'd come home and there'd be all these dad and mum collected all this amazing furniture in America, these Charles Eames furniture, the original Barcelona chairs. And which I got in the, I made sure I said to my brother and sister that when my parents die, the one thing I do want is the bench from Lord's, because mum knew the architects, have I got it right, Norman Foster, who was doing the mound stand at Lord's, and they were, for some extraordinary reason, and it would never happen now, they were actually throwing out some of the benches. And mum said, oh, can we have some of these old Lord's benches for, they weren't the MCC ones, but they were in the stand next to it, for the house in Highgate. And they said, yeah, they were literally in skips outside. So mum went and collected a couple. And I said to my brother and sister, I said, listen, I want the Lord's benches. And I actually WhatsApp, which you can do nowadays, the MCC library, and I said, can I say that someone in the 30s would have sat there and watched, I don't know, Larwood and Vaux, famous sort of batsmen and bowlers at the time, and they said, yeah, that's definitely it. So we got it lovingly restored. But then so I inherited, I've got the Barcelona chairs as well. But I mean, I would come back home to 81 Swains Lane, as architectural students knew it, and there'd be no furniture there. And I'd go, oh no, we have burglars or whatever. And it would end up on a film. And if you watch the VIPs now, I think it's Taylor and Burton have a snog on one of the sofas. We've got an e-sofa as well as the Barcelona chairs. So all that sort of stuff. But at the same time, the reason why I loved that house so much is because from my room, I could look out onto Waterloo Park over Highgate New Cemetery, where Karl Marx was. And actually, I think the first interview I ever did was being interviewed very young, when Karl Marx and people tried to blow him up, and ITN or the BBC or a local reporter from the Ham and High came down, and they asked me, what was it exciting? Because you're the person whose room was nearest to it. And he said, well, it just went bang and wasn't much of an explosion. There's still a line you can see in the bust of his nose. But anyway, looking past him, sorry, Carl, but looking past him, I could actually just see this little glimpse of green, my Wembley, which was where the local kids used to play football. And so I used to go and sort of join in with them on a Sunday.
So I can see your father's influence and your mother's here in your garden, because you've got this lovely converted barn, beautiful stone buildings with a beautiful dovecote. And then you've made the spaces quite clean and modern and strong, full of quite lush planting. And we are right down at the bottom, and this valley overlooks this river. Spectacular views. I've worked on gardens on either side of you, and they all seem to have this view, don't they? They're amazing. And the guy next door, I remember, he widened the river slightly surreptitiously to make it really nice on the QT.
Yeah.
But
you can see the stepping stones there.
Oh, that's new.
And I mean, people talk about the quality of water, but you know,
it does look pretty good, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily sort of mix cocktails with it, but you would happily swim in it.
Do you swim in it?
Yeah.
He didn't, but you do regularly.
Yeah, absolutely. Not regularly, but yeah, absolutely, no problem. Mm. I mean,
what was it? What do you call them? The brown fish?
Oh, brown fish.
Tyne. You have none of those here.
So the famous Tyne swim, which the BBC very kindly filmed and stuck it on their website, so I can't really escape from it.
Oh, but I can see. I didn't see that.
I mean, obviously, this is Newcastle. Anything football related, I said I was going to do it for a famous local football charity, Sir Bobby Robson Foundation, and they just thought it was hilarious that this thick London journalist who makes terrible predictions on social media was coming up to swim the Tyne.
They didn't think you'd make it. What is the distance?
It's only about 200 yards.
But I regularly see you cycling these hills around here like a maniac.
Fit.
No problem to you. So why couldn't do it?
Well, yeah, but then it all got a little bit carried away because I said, all right, I'll swim the Tyne. And then a marine biologist came on and said, you've got to be really careful. And then someone else came on. This is the madness of social media. Someone else came on this long thread about this thick London journalist sort of having to swim the Tyne. And they said, oh, by the way, be careful what colour wetsuit you use, don't have a grey one because it's the seal mating season. and you might finally get shagged by sort of some frisky flipper merchant. And then another marine biologist came on and said, don't be stupid, it's not the seal mating season, but it is the sea otter mating season. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to swim quite quickly and make sure I have a bright-coloured wetsuit. But then the Port of Tyne authority then came on and very seriously said, listen, you don't mess with, we will give you permission to do this. And I said, I need permission, do I? Said, yes, you need permission, but actually be careful because we have to fish out a couple of, you know, Newcastle students every year, so be careful.
The tides,
Of the Tyne.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the tides in the Tyne.
Yeah, the tide, yeah.
Yeah. Well, drag you under.
Yeah, there's a big current in the middle, as I discovered. So they said, you can do it if you do it with this professional guide.
Yeah.
And I rang him up, and I could feel him rolling his eyes. And he said, I said, I've got to swim the Tyne. He paused and went, widthways or lengthways? And I went, widthways. And he said, all right, okay, we can do that, not lengthways. So, but we did, but we swam at an angle. And a mate of mine who was working for Sky Sports, and the reason why I was up there that day was a big Newcastle match with Manchester United playing in the afternoon. So I did it at lunchtime. Newcastle people laid on a press boat with four cameras on it. I mean, it was just, I thought, this has really escalated. Anyway,
so you looked nicely to camera all the way across.
Yes, I did. Yeah, well.
Yeah, showing your best side.
Well, neither side, unfortunately, when you're in there. But so Mason Mann, who was working for Sky Sports, was down at the quayside, and he said, well, will you do a few words for Sky? Because we're just doing normal sort of Fox Pops to fill before matches. And I said, sure. And so I did this thing. And just before I dived in from the quayside, he turned to the camera, said, right, now back to the studio. This is a momentous day for Sky because we've never had a drowning in high definition before. So I said, thanks, mate. So I dived in. Oh, before I dived in, someone said, oh, watch out for the brown fish. I said, well, brown fish? What on earth's that? I discovered about a third of the way across.
Masses of them, or just one or two?
No, but I think one's enough. So I had a good wash afterwards. But you know, what I didn't realise is there's a lot of wood in there. There are obviously sort of bottles and things in there. But apparently it is actually quite clean. And they've seen, I don't know, not porpoises or whatever, but they do get frisky seals coming up looking for a little bit of Sunday morning fun. Anyway, I got to the other side and
raised a fortune.
And
no doubt.
Well, not a huge amount, but the Newcastle people are so generous that when I was walking back up to the ground afterwards, they were coming up to me in the days when people had cash and said, "Here's £5."
Oh, lovely.
You know, stick it in. Yeah. So that was.
So next time when you say something that you're totally sure about, and you say, "I'll do this if it doesn't happen,"
I've got one. I'm really nervous about it because England are recruiting a new manager at the moment. And I've got, if Jose Mourinho gets the job, another stupid prediction I made, I said, Jose Mourinho will never become England manager. This is about 10 years ago, just before Southgate got the job. I said, Jose Mourinho, because there was a lot of speculation, Mourinho's going to get the England job. And I said, if Jose Mourinho gets the England job, I'll swim the Tyne dressed as Mrs. Doubtfire.
Well, that's easy. You've done it once.
Yeah, but Mrs. Doubtfire as well. I mean, first I might get dragged down by the sort of the weight of the clothes, but also it's not a particularly elegant look.
Anyway, you're carried off, Henry, and you're strong enough to do it. I'm looking forward to that.
Let me know
when it happens.
It'll be filmed.
So the other things about you, there's lots of extraordinary things about you, Henry, is that you were a chorister at Westminster School. So do you still sing?
No, very badly. And there's some.
But you were good. You must have been good.
I was okay. I won a singing competition at the prep school that I was at, which probably helped me get into Westminster. Look, I got into Westminster because my brother's one of the brightest men in the country. He's Islamic scholar. I think he's head of Islamic studies at Cambridge. Scholar at Cambridge. Exhibitionist. Double star first. The brightest guy in the country. 38th most influential Muslim in the world, which I will take him seriously when he gets ahead of Mo Salah of Liverpool and Egypt fame. He's still one behind him. I'm very proud of my brother. But I mean, the good thing about my family is because all four of them, Mum, Dad, Tim and Martha, have been so good in their own fields.
Mm.
There was absolutely no point competing with them. There was no point competing with my brother academically. But I loved singing. And it was my mother used to come and listen to me sing in the Abbey in the morning. And we are so blessed in this country. Bunny, you know, you travel around a lot. With the buildings that we've got, with the history.
Phenomenal.
I can look at the outside of Westminster Abbey and just think of Edward the Confessor and Purcell, the great choir master there. And little things like, you know, you go up in, well, I went up into the Triforium. I think you can pay to go up there, but the Triforum is that bit around the top where they did all the filming for the coronation. And it's remarkable up there, but laid down along there are the really big, weighty pipes, organ pipes. So you've got the organ loft, which I've sung in, which is spectacular because you can see either way, and you just feel all the sort of pomp and ceremony. But I think what they do, and I think they still do it because they changed some pipes, certainly in the last few years, they always try to keep like 1% of the old pipe and mix it in so that they can say it goes back 400 years to when Henry Purcell was choir master there. Mm. So I love that there. And maybe it's the sort of, you know, the tribal football man in me, but I'm actually quite critical of St. Paul's. St. Paul's, just famous, that was at that harsh photograph from the Second World War where then the Blitz was at its worst and it's all dark, but there was St. Paul's standing like Churchill, the symbol of British defiance. Very famous photograph, so I got huge admiration for it. But you know, when it was on the television for one of the sort of royal weddings, events, christenings, whatever, divorces, I just went, I think I actually tweeted, and I very rarely tweet about non-things, and said, you know, beautiful building, but terrible acoustics compared to Westminster Abbey. And I was thinking, that's kind of like a sort of Celtic Rangers rivalry or Norwich City against Ipswich. And again, everything comes back to that prism. But for 2-3 years, going into Westminster Abbey 3-4 times a week early and singing, and then I actually did go and sing. They ran out of choristers in the choir at St. Paul's. And this was in the late 70s. And they had a big event, which was to celebrate the memory and also the lives of the remaining field marshals from the Second World War. And they ran out singers, so I got sort of roped into it. Mm. So to sing there and to look at all these great military veterans, these stooped warriors walking up the aisle of St. Paul's, you think, what an amazing country. What an amazing, also privilege for me personally, just to be there. But yeah, Westminster was special, and there is still some very grainy black and white footage of me with rosy apple cheeks singing in the pews. And whenever I see one of the events and I see there's a politician going, that's my individual pew. Actually, you had one of the sort of the nice arch ones in the choir stalls. I was at the back, and then when my voice broke, I managed to hide behind a couple of very good singers for a couple of months and then got found out. And I have, so that's one of the low points in my life. Because I absolutely loved that opportunity, that access to that historical privilege.
Your brother said about you, I think, is really fascinating. So he said, Tim said, I was always a clever, successful one. Henry just wanted to play football with his mates. I used to tell him, I'm going to make loads of money and you'll still be playing football with your mates. But now you, Henry, are living in a house with 10 bedrooms and married to a Bond girl. So I take it you were competitive.
I can't believe when he said that, because he very rarely talks to the press, but I think he really liked the Independent. He really liked the religious correspondent there. And so he spoke to them. And when that came out, I think it was in the early days of social media. And it was, oh, look at him now, living in a 10-bedroom house in the country and married to a Bond girl. I sent him a message and I said, listen, mate. I didn't call him mate. He's got so many long, he's actually Sheikh now. He's so important, I always stand up to text to him as a gesture of respect. But I said, listen, Tim. You know, if you're talking to the press, at least make me sound cool. At least say it's a one-bedroom house with 10 Bond girls, because at least that would come out. So, but no, like, I'm incredibly proud that he is that he is my brother, and he does. You know, in a slightly tense world, when you've got someone who is so intelligent as Tim, who can see both sides, because he's kind of like English establishment. He's got his foot there, and he's got his foot in, obviously, very much in the Islamic world. And I went to, where's I was at the Times, and I went to Saudi, I went to Jeddah, and when people heard that I was there, because I was tweeting I was there, and this was like last November, I was just getting just so many messages from, you know, people quite high up saying, we want to meet you, you are Sheikh Abdul Hakim Tim's. He's one of those American freight trains, his names. He keeps on having bits added to it as he goes on and becomes more sort of distinguished. I love this one, because he is effectively in the divinity faculty at Cambridge. And I just love the idea of him having this nameplate on the door, which, you know, the poor caretaker has to come on and say, "Oh, Mr. Winter, you've got another name, another honour." But yeah, it was quite amusing in Qatar in the 2018 World Cup. I'd obviously been very critical about the way that Qatar got the World Cup, and B, the way that, sorry, it's the 2022. And the way that the stadiums were built, the migrant labour, kafala system, the misogyny, homophobia. I mean, I basically write about headers and volleys, but actually the way that the media landscape has changed, the focus on football almost as a window on society and societal issues. I write about taking the knee, I write about food poverty as well as headers and volleys. So I'd written a lot about that, but I got a summons, not a summons, but a very polite message from the Emir to go and play paddle with one of his paddle mates. So I went into the local Lily White and got some, sat in Doha, and got some gear and went and...
Had you played paddle before?
Never, right. Never.
It is quite easy to play well, isn't it?
I think it's easy to tennis. I'm very good at playing things badly, and that's my level. So I went and thought, well, I'll go and play them badly. And then I will just, they'll want to sort of stop the game because they don't like the great sport of paddle being humiliated by such an amateur as this daft guy from England. So I thought, I actually looked okay. I had a sort of decent outfit on and until the first ball got struck. But on the next court were two of Argentina and Brazil's most famous ever footballers, who I'd spent the last sort of like 25 years trying to interview. And I was going, Ronaldo, the original Ronaldo, and Batistuta, Gabriel Batistuta, who for me is just one of the greatest strikers who ever lived, playing paddle on the next court. And I'm playing with one of the sort of the Emir's mates. And so it was a slightly surreal experience. And then the Emir came over, very tall, very imposing character, and talked very briefly about the Western press, the English press, criticism of it. And he was absolutely such a charming man. But I actually only got that access because of Tim. So thanks, Tim.
And you thrashed him, I hope, at paddle.
No, I think he put me out of my misery very early.
But did you get to talk to your heroes after after next door?
Do you know what? Paddle's a crazy sport, and you can see why it's just sort of taking over
off
the country.
Meteoric.
Yeah, I actually spoke to the LTA and to Wimbledon about it, and I said, "What are you doing about it? Because this is a threat to you." And I said, "No, we're going to embrace it because the more people who get into racket sports, and this is another issue in the country, we have an issue with obesity in this country." And anything that encourages people to take up sports. So that's why the Lionesses, and many reasons why I love the Lionesses, partly because they're a bunch of winners, but they genuinely care about British society, English society. This is obviously the women's team, the England's women team, who won the European Championships at Wembley. You know, and you get people like Leah Williamson plays for Arsenal. She's one of the most impressive people you can meet in life, let alone in sport. Learning football. And the day after her and one of the other players, the day after this great victory where the men would still be running around Vegas or Ibiza or wherever, they wrote a letter to Starmer and to whoever was the Tory leader at the time, Sunak. They seem to change every 5 minutes. And I'm not a huge fan of politicians because I actually think the moral leadership of the country, a lot of it comes from our sportsmen and women. And particularly with Leah Williamson, who's I cannot tell you how impressive she is. I remember going to interview her at Arsenal and she was talking, we're talking football, obviously, headers and volleys, dreams for the season. And then I knew that she was involved in one of the many Arsenal schemes. And she just goes out and saves lives. You know, you've got these kids just sort of trying to sort of find some sustenance on a sort of pile of nothing in wherever in some, you know, benighted country. And she's brilliant like that. Anyway, so she and Lottie wrote this amazing letter to all the political leaders and they were going to send it whether they won or lost the final. And they sent this letter just saying, we have a problem with school sport in this country. I went to a well-known school, fabulous sporting facilities. I spent my childhood going to Eton and I was at Westminster, so going to Eton and Harrow and all these places, thrashing them at football. We had a good football team. But the facility, you go somewhere like Eton I mean, you know, you literally have to, for our old boys team, you literally changed, then got back in your car because the pitch was, we played on, was so far away, and you went past pitch after pitch after pitch. And you look at that and you know you're privileged that you get that. But what the point that Lair was making, obviously she grew up through an academy system, fantastic pitches, but she was saying, effectively state school systems in this country, she wasn't picking out state schools, she was talking generally about education, we have such an issue, particularly with women's football and women's sport at school, the access to it is just disgraceful, and the government is responsible for that, and the government should be investing more. And then
My father banging on about this. Always been the case.
But it's worse now. It is worse. Issue with obesity, childhood obesity.
Yeah, it's
so
got worse.
Just one thing to finish on this rant. I actually went to see one of the ministers. This was in 2016 because I was writing a book on the state of English football. It's when I was on gardening leave, leaving the Telegraph to go to the Times. I had 4 months. I thought, my garden's nice, but it's not going to take 4 months. So I wrote this book and I went to see one of the ministers at the time. I said, you know what you want to do? You want to take like 1% of your budget, this minister's budget, which is about 113 billion at the time, and invest it into school sport. And if you did that, you would save the pressure, and this was way before COVID, save the pressure on the NHS. And you know, as the feel-good factor in the country would grow because you've got more elite, I was looking at it from the terms of elite athletes coming through for the sort of the England men's and women's team, excuse me, but also generally takes less pressure off the NHS. And he said, it's an absolute brilliant idea. We've been thinking about it for ages, taking 1% of our budget, investing it in state school sport, more teachers, more facilities, more hours in the curriculum. It's an absolute brilliant idea. I said, well, why don't you do it? He said, why should I help my successor?
That is the problem with the political system. But, I mean, they're selling off playing fields left, right and centre, aren't
they? So I'm involved in the London Playing Fields Foundation in London, who, you know, Harry Kane, people like that. Harry Kane's been absolutely brilliant on that. So I do get slightly defensive when footballers get criticised, and some of them are idiots. And then, you know, and I have seen the behaviour of some of them. But actually, the majority of them want to look after their family. They don't sleep around. A lot of them don't drink during the season anyway, because you can't, because you're an elite athlete. And they do amazing work. Like the work that Jack Grealish does with his sister's got cerebral palsy. And Jack is always going into hospitals, he's going to schools. I mean, Jordan Henderson got a lot of stick, quite rightly, when, you know, having been a flag bearer for the fight against homophobia, then to go and play in Saudi, and he was a Liverpool captain, and it was a terrible mistake he made. But the work that he has done, I remember going to an autism school with him, and there were 20 kids in this class, and there were 19 outside in the sunshine, and he was sort of doing races with them and playing football with them and doing amazing, this is when he was Liverpool captain, he was doing amazing things with them. And then he was sort of split them up into two. He said, 10 aside, but you're only 19. Where's one of the other kids? And she was inside and she couldn't cope with all the noise and the lights. So she was just sort of sitting in the classroom. So when he finished playing with these kids, he went back in and he sat with her for like 15 minutes. And just, she had her book. She was a Liverpool fan and she had her book. And she was going through the club programme, and she was going, just pointing out the picture for his programme notes and then pointing at him and then talking. And her mum was there. And her mum was just saying, this is one of the few times that she's actually communicated. And I stayed in contact with her mum. She was saying, just that one moment, you know, the clouds of autism that was just made life so difficult for her to communicate, those clouds disappeared for the time that she was with Jordan Henderson. Marcus Rashford, I can remember walking around there when Marcus Rashford was taking on Boris Johnson over child food poverty and the breakfast clubs. And I was talking to some of Boris's mates, because you get to know people in life, and they were saying, what's this footballer doing? You know, he's not going to run rings around the Prime Minister. This is the Prime Minister. Why does he keep calling the Prime Minister out? And say, well, actually, he's not calling the Prime Minister out. He's very, in a very measured way, I know Marcus quite well, in a very Manchester United and England player, in a very measured way, he is talking about what he has seen wrong from his own experiences. His mother had 3 jobs, 3 kids, struggled to feed them. And she, and you know, he would hear his mum crying herself to sleep at night because she didn't have enough food to get them through breakfast in the morning. So Marcus vowed to his mum, he said, when he's older, when he's made it as a footballer, he was determined to make it at Manchester United, he would just make sure these breakfast clubs, so that kids would go into school on a full stomach, which obviously is great for their health, but also means they concentrate in class more. So it helps everyone. So you haven't got a couple of disruptive, hungry kids in the background whose and parents haven't been able to afford. So
his power was amazing, wasn't it? That he flipped that and the
and
politics
Boris,
just got
so
totally
I was talking
wrong.
To Boris's mates, and I was going, I'm sorry, this kid, A, he's got a social media platform, B, he's got a cause, always in sport, never take on someone who's got a cause, on a mission, and he was absolutely on a mission, and obviously with his social media platform. And Boris, inevitably, as all of us told him, had to do his U-turn. So again, this moral leadership, the moral compass of the country, which is a constant debate, which I read about in the op-ed pages of The Telegraph and The Times and The Guardian, and I'm going, have a look in the dressing rooms of this country, the men's, the women's, the rugby, the cricket, you know, okay, there's some idiots in there, but actually the majority of them, because, you know, I will go and talk to these players and I will talk to them about their background. I mean, at Westminster, we ate off, supposedly, the tables which were Spanish boats which were washed up after the Armada. We had that privilege. We had three-course meals. We had amazing sports facilities, or pretty good football facilities, behind the Tate Gallery. You know, and then you talk to these kids and what they have battled through to get to the top. Mm. I mean, we're talking just after the Olympics, the sacrifices that they have made individually and their families. And I just think, anyway, it's just a thing that, final thing on that, the French have got an absolute brilliant system. They take one elite athlete who's retiring every year and attach them to the Lycée Palace. So they will go and advise Macron, because a lot of them are from, you know, difficult, disadvantaged communities on the edge of Paris, and they will go in and say, it's a tinderbox in this community, in Les Ulis or wherever, where Thierry Henry came from. You need to do this. And of course, because of their profile in society, because they're successful athletes, men and women, people listen to them. I think it's a brilliant system.
That's interesting.
Anyway, rant over.
Back to your education then. So after Westminster, then you went to Edinburgh to do English.
Yeah, because I screwed up Oxbridge and I couldn't be bothered to resit it, because I set it very early and I couldn't be bothered. I knew what I wanted to do. I'd just been at school in Munich for a term. I loved it there. I just wanted to travel, go to places like Munich again, go back to the Olympic Stadium,
but,
and write about football.
What I found interesting is quite a small group of you at Edinburgh, but amongst your 5 year, you had Isabel Bannerman and Sarah Raven. Is that right?
In your class. In my class. Yeah. No, it was. Yeah. I mean, I didn't realise. I mean, they were just lovely. Just lovely people. Isabel Eustace, as she was, became Isabel Bannerman. I think she was quite an established model at the time. She was tall and very impressive.
She's cracking looking, isn't she?
She
superb,
is.
Really,
yeah.
But
again, what you like to see is just people doing well and reaching for the stars. And my parents just basically said, just do what you want. Do what you're passionate about. Do, you know, just as long as you do what you're passionate about. They were probably quite snooty when I graduated in 85, came down and went and knocked on doors at Fleet Street before actually heading up to Highgate to see them. But actually they understood this was your passion, just follow it.
And so Sarah Raven and Isabel Bannerman, no, now Isabel's obviously a very successful
This
gardener.
Is where you get excited, isn't it? Because
yeah,
it's gardeners.
Absolutely.
I can see your green fingers twitching with excitement.
Have you seen them recently or
I
not?
I saw Sarah at Chelsea this year. I went and had a chat with her.
And did she recognise you? Did you recognise her?
I recognise her because she's a bit difficult to, it's like you, Bunny. It's a bit difficult to avoid every time I open a colour supplement. You know, you've got one of your esteemed columns in the Telegraph, and Sarah's obviously her catalogue comes through the doors. But yeah. No, I'm just really proud of them. It's just like I'm proud of friends at school. You know, one of them went off and became a really well-known rock star, you know, sort of actors, surgeons. And but also you look at a job like that, you know, she employs people. She's got, is it her farm or her pottery centre
out in the fens they made last year or something,
yeah.
A massive business,
but the money's irrelevant. She's doing something that she's absolutely passionate about, like you, Bunny. I know you because you're passionate about what you do, and I'll sit next to people at dinner parties and they can be passionate about, I know, dentistry, they can be passionate about carpentry, they can be passionate about politics, as long as they're genuinely passionate about it, there's nothing worse than talking to someone in their mid-50s, early 60s, who've had a very lucrative career and it's given them a nice life, but they haven't really enjoyed their job. And they actually get a little bit sort of guilty. I've been swanning around the world for 40 years doing what I love. I'm incredibly selfish.
But I think in horticulture particularly, it's quite unusual to be, lots of us are passionate about it, but to make huge amounts of money, I think, is very unusual. So the combined skills, I think, is what makes it fascinating.
But Bunny, I'll interrupt you, because it's one thing that the great managers, like Sir Alex Ferguson at Manchester United, always told the young players, follow your passion and then the money will follow.
Quite possibly, but not often. In horticulture, I have to say. But comparing horticulture to football, I think it's something like, is it 5 billion, that the total revenue from horticulture and business and everything? And what do you think it is in football, the total revenue from the Premier League, the contribution to the economy?
In tax? Well, the tax is unbelievable. That
not
footballers
tax,
get
the
tax.
Amount that it generates.
Oh, God, I don't know. I mean, it'd be off the scale. I mean, all I know is that any, let's say, take Ipswich at the moment. What it will mean, it will be a 10% increase to all the local businesses in Ipswich Town. Sorry, in Ipswich. The
really?
Fact that, absolutely.
When they're playing?
No, when they're in the Premier League.
Oh.
If the team's doing well.
Really?
Yeah, because have many people around the world, with respect, heard of Ipswich? But when they're in the Premier League's huge. When you see trade delegations go abroad, there'll be Premier League officials in the background because everyone's heard of the Premier League. When I was writing a book, I went and sat in an American pub, very English pub in Santa Monica. And I went in there at 6 o'clock in the morning and had a coffee, very responsible. And I sat there for about 10 hours just to see the interest in Premier League football, because obviously the timing, they had all the games going on, heaving. And that Premier League is colossal around the world. So if I go to another country, people say, oh, you write about the EPL. They're absolutely safe. So coming back to
EPL.
Your point, it's called EPL, it's known as the English Premier League.
Oh, right, okay.
But it's huge. I mean, it's the biggest, it's one of our biggest successes. I mean,
5.5, they reckon, to 8 billion in revenue it generated in 22, and horticulture was 5 billion. So it's way bigger than the whole of the horticultural industry.
Can I say,
it's phenomenal,
I'm
isn't it?
I'm surprised it's not more than that.
Are you?
Yeah.
Well,
exactly.
This is 22 figures. Well, aren't we trying to break into the States? Aren't the States becoming more
huge.
Involved in English?
Huge.
Yeah. But becoming more so, and that will absolutely drive it much higher, won't it?
If I go over a game in the States, I will get local soccer fans say, right, will you come along and have a chat with us? And there'll be 300 people in the room. I mean, it's just colossal. I did one the other night, and it was just on a Zoom, and it's just huge.
Really?
Yeah, it's partly because, you know, you think of America, everyone thinks of America as just sort of American sport, the indigenous American sport. But actually, what percentage of the country are Spanish speakers? And they tend to be absolutely obsessed with football. And why do you think Messi's gone there?
Yeah.
I mean, he's not foolish. And obviously, it's the fastest growing participation sport, because there are obviously a lot of concerns about American football because of concussion, and they think that soccer, although you can get concussion, quite bad concussion in soccer as they call it. But I mean, I covered the World Cup there in 94. There was very little interest in it. I went on a radio phone-in, and they said, oh, we got this Mr. Winner from London, England, who's going to talk about this soccer bowl competition that's going on. This was in Chicago. And Mr. Winner, if you want to just tell us about this, the beautiful game, as Pelé called it, and then we'll open up the phone lines. We normally do it, I have our phone in. And so I talked about the beautiful game, why it's the world's most popular game, why it was so beautiful. I talked for about sort of 10 minutes on that. I said, right, well, let's open up the phone lines. And he said, we got John from downtown Chicago. And said, John, what's your question? There's a lovely pause and went, getting back to OJ. So it was the OJ Simpson case when he was being chased down the boule of the highways by the American thing. And that summed it up. The next World Cup is there in 2026. You will not be able to move, because all the tickets probably have all sold out already. Mm. And they'll sell them out to locals, let alone travelling fans. So it's colossal.
I remember someone said that you quoted it saying, I roll my eyes at football being pigeonholed as the working class game. It's the nation's game. Yeah, an obsession pervading all strata of society. A sport with its roots in the southern public schools such as Eton, as well as the northern mill towns like Blackburn and Bolton. And Churchill's old quote, wasn't it? Football is a gentleman's game played by hooligans, and rugby is a hooligan's game played by gentlemen.
Quite
but
clever, that.
Football really is the new religion, isn't it? It's tribal.
Yeah.
It pervades through all classes of society.
Yeah.
And it's spreading throughout the world.
But it slightly annoyed me. And I know with everything comes back to class in this country, which I find really boring.
Yeah.
I think
but it's a very it's a
we're a very class ridden country.
But more than any other country in the world. Do you find that when you travel?
More stratified.
Yeah,
totally class obsessed country. You know, it's like the Americans, everyone's judged on money.
Money.
Over here, everyone's judged on class, which is just so boring.
It has changed, wouldn't you say, in the last 5 years? Social media's changed it big time more than most
things. A little bit. But anyway, I think I'm interested in people's foregrounds. I mean, to an extent, their background in terms of what shaped them. But also, it's a slight myth in football. And to be honest, I got a bit bored sort of arguing it at the end, because as a kid, I grew up, you know, at prep school, football. At senior school, we played 2 terms football. We played more football than the local comprehensive. They battered us when we played Pimlico comprehensive. They battered us on and off the pitch. But absolutely, we played a lot of football. People go, why were they Eton College? It's, you know, at one point, the old Etonians had won the FA Cup more times than Chelsea up until about 30 years ago. Okay, that's a historical thing, but the roots are in, you know, Eton and Westminster and Shrewsbury and Radley and Repton and places like that. So it's a slight myth that, but then, as ever, people like to stratify and classify things.
Were you any good at football at school?
Totally hopeless. I mean, I played non-league at university, which was great. So
but
at one
so
point,
at school, were you in the football team?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Of course. So you must have been quite good. Yeah, so to say you're useless.
Yeah.
But did you...
No, but so useless... So by public school standards...
You were good.
I was good.
Yeah.
But at the moment... So I would go and play with my mates at the weekends who were... I didn't understand that they went to the local comprehensive. It just didn't make any difference to me, because, you know, as the Brazilians say, on the beach everyone's equal, on the pitch everyone's equal. They don't know my background. I think one or two of them knew that I went to a sort of, you know, vaguely smart school, but when I went to university they had the university football trials, and I sort of bumbled along, and they were all in their like school strips or Ranger strips or Celtic strips. There were some very good players who won the books of professional clubs. And I turned up in the only football strip I have, which was the Westminster one, which is a pink shirt, white cuffs, black satin shorts, pink socks with a nice white trim around it, little garters as well, and probably your mother had put your sort of, you know, H.O. Winter Wren's house in it, just in case anyone sort of, they didn't nick things at Westminster, but it might have sort of disappeared or whatever. And I sort of turned up, and they just looked at me. So there was big trials. They're like 200, 18, 19-year-olds, first-year trials on this windswept pitches. And I thought, I really want to get in the first team. I want to edit the sports editor of the student newspaper. I knew everything that I wanted to do. I basically knew I wanted to play football there. And I turned up, and I didn't think about who all these people were, but they did look at me slightly oddly. And I would say, well, I got through the trial somehow.
Oh, so
they
you did?
Yeah. I played for the university. Yeah. Which was brilliant. And I was the only English person in the club, which was about 80 people, until someone joined from Eton. And I was going, go away, I'm the only posh twat here. But that was great. And we sort of travelled all over Scotland and played. I've still got the scars, played East of Scotland League, and that was brilliant. But again,
you didn't think then, if you were sort of in age 9, you wanted to start going professional and done trials?
No
and
chance. But sorry.
But did no one pick you up on it, or did no one give you that opportunity? But do you think you could have done it?
Ability, but also background. But again, sort of background.
Yeah.
So people from my background, absolutely, it's different now, but absolutely no chance you were going to go and become a journalist, particularly if you went to Westminster, you were going to go and become a journalist. No one ever thought about elite sport.
But if you had not had that background, if someone had picked you up, like someone had spotted Eric Dyer in Portugal.
Yeah,
and
Eric's
said that,
different.
Do you think you would have had any chance of making it anywhere near the Premier League? If you'd
chance.
Because
Bonnie,
of what?
But ability?
Because I always think it's fascinating what makes a top footballer, and a load of kids want to do it from quite an early age.
Do you know the percentage?
Tiny.
But beyond tiny.
Really minuscule. It's frightening. And what is it, though, that makes them? It apart from drive, determination, massively quick thinking skills, aren't they?
Yeah,
very good reactions.
Everyone thinks Wayne Rooney's thick. Wayne Rooney's one of the brightest people you can talk to.
In terms of reaction times.
Yeah, people just think that
if
hear
you
the
put
scouse
him on
voice.
University Challenge, you might not do so well, but he's got other...
On his specialist subject.
On his specialist subject. But
He's got a... He has a sort of mental...
it's different types of mental ability, aren't they? I quite agree. I think to anyone to play a sport at high level, I think you have a huge focus.
So here's the thing.
So
one of the best footballers in the last 20, 30 years is a guy called Andres Iniesta, who won the Champions League, played for Barcelona, played for Spain, won the World Cup. Brilliant player. When he got to 30, 31, he went and did a second degree because he just wanted to use it just to keep his brain as sharp as ever. He was interested in the academic exercise. He was interested in the subject that he was learning. But actually, it was, you know, these guys are so clever. They leave nothing to chance.
You've
interviewed Eric.
Okay,
Eric is maybe an exception in terms of his, you know, his family background and the fact they went and lived overseas. But if you had a chat with Marcus Rashford, even though he's a slightly introverted individual, you would come away with the impression, my God, there's a real thinker in there. But these are kids. Eric had a sort of slightly, because of his family, he had a sort of slightly sort of broader view of the world. But remember, these are kids who are going into the system at 5 and 6. They have their passports taken away from them. They have everything, a lot done for them. And it's all about this pursuit of excellence. It's the hardest industry to get into. And you talk to these footballers and you just think, it's easier to make it as a best-selling band than it is to make it as an elite footballer.
Absolutely. I have huge admiration for them. I've never thought they were thick because their reaction times and everything. And the very fact that the whole of their life has been so focused on making it must exclude other things, like me focusing on plants and horticulture.
Yeah.
You know, I have huge blanks in my memory in other areas.
I can't believe that, Bunny.
As the family knows. And I don't know if you do. You seem pretty wide, I have to say, because you've mixed with a huge range of influences, haven't you?
Yeah.
And things, which is fascinating.
I'm a good listener, which may sound odd in a podcast, but Kat always laughs because if we go to a dinner party and I'm sitting
next to someone. This is the Bond girl we're talking about.
The
Bond girl.
She did audition for the credits or whatever it was. But if I'm sitting next to someone, I want their life story. If I'm on a train, I'm really nosy. It's probably why I got into journalism. But I'm genuinely interested in what makes people tick.
Mm.
Partly because I don't have any chips on my shoulder but from my upbringing. So it just sort of crack on and just sort of talk to people. And I'm fascinated with people. I want their life story.
Yeah.
And that's why I love interviewing.
Yeah.
A fascinating insight into Henry's life and football. Next week, we hear more about gardening and a bit more about football.
Riley Herbst from 2311 Racing here. And you know what grinds my gears? Waiting for coffee. But instead of counting frappes and lattes, I fire up Chumba Casino. No apps, no fuss, just fun social casino games to pass the time. By the time my coffee's ready,
order for Riley.
I've already taken a few victory laps. Next time you're stuck waiting, make it entertaining. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.